I get very confused when people say I'm thinking of starting something, because I don't understand how you can think. You know, I mean, startup is such a stupid idea. You know, if you think, you will never do it. I mean, if you think logically, you should never do it. But you know, interestingly, India is nothing more than a chiller market. It doesn't matter where you start from, because India has this radioactive half-life theory on spreads. So if you are making 100 basis point spreads on the first year, and next year you'll make only 50. Third year will make 25, fourth year will make 12.5, and fifth year that guy will tell you, you pay me for giving you the business, right? Every one of us is a friction point. We don't realize it, we are a friction point. Now we can say we are enablers, our tech makes it much more easier, blah blah blah.
Wow, that's
nonsense.
That's old.
All intermediaries. The question really I had in Vayana when we started off is that, do we want to be a visible intermediary or an invisible intermediary?
So on this week's episode, we talked to Ram Iyer, the founder and CEO of Vayana. After three successful startups, Ram is now building India's largest B2B credit trade network. Vayana facilitated over $30 billion in trade financing. They cover thousands of supply chains and operate in 20 plus countries across 25 industries. Join us as we talk to Ram about his inspiring journey. Hello, everyone, and welcome, Ram, to Founders Unfiltered. Great to have you here.
Hey, same here, Imazan. Great to be on this podcast.
So Ram, let's jump into it. Let's start off with the rapid fire round. If you could be a professional in any other field unrelated to your current work, what would it be and why?
Two things interest me, which I'm not good at, but you know, I would love to be a music critic. Okay. I don't know why. I don't sing. I'm tone deaf, but you know, I would have liked to be a music critic, I guess. And second, I guess is Zen coach. Yeah, a lot of my friends and colleagues have become executive coaches and all. I love this idea of spending time with others and giving fun. You know, some advice, God only knows what it is, but you know, I like that word Zen coach. I think that it always appealed.
Zen coach. Okay, that's a new one. I've not heard that before. So it's helping executives keep mental balance, I guess. That's different. And so what's on your bucket list?
I would love to travel, yeah. I mean, this is a very interesting thing. You said you're from Bangkok, right? So I've actually traveled 36 times to Bangkok. And I haven't seen it once. I mean, I've only been in Seoul and gone to the meetings. So yeah, almost every place that I've gone in, I think I've gone to many places. I haven't seen any of them actually as a tourist, I guess. So I guess one definite on the bucket list is to go as a tourist, which I've done to about a couple of places, but not too many. I think that's one. And two is not to have a mobile with me.
Completely disconnect.
But I would love to avoid the mobile totally.
So one question you'd ask yourself if you were the host of the show. So this is kind of a lazy question we ask everyone and then I'll ask it back to you. But what would you want the host?
Have anything better to do on a Sunday. yeah, but I guess, look, I mean, you know, one question that always strikes me is, you know, which should get asked to, I think, all founders especially, is, do you think you are fit for the role that you currently are on? You know, I mean, you know, I think it's a very important question to ask, which I don't think many people ask. You know, I mean, we obviously start a company, we become the CEO or whatever it is, something we become. And, you know, 10 years later, we're successful, somebody assumes that we just have a right to be there. I think it's just a question to ask. That could be one of your rapid fire, you know, questions which you, you know, spring on.
Yes, founders. No, that's a good one. Yeah. I will definitely ask you. We'll come back to that. But continue the rapid fire. On to the business questions. Bootstrap versus funded?
Bootstrap.
Why is that? Why bootstrap?
I think it gives you a lot more. If you're building a company, right? If you're building a business, I think it gives you a lot more ability to kind of shape the company that you want. I think where the funded one, you know, you can get great investors like we do. And you have the ability to do that. But I still think bootstrap gives you a lot more options to, first of all, worry about your business profitability right from day one. It gets you really focused on that. And second, I think it makes you also, and it gives you a tremendous ability to shape it up the way you want. You know, and I think that's a very, very important thing for at least a founder.
Oh, that's good advice. I think nowadays, of course, a lot more focus on profitability. What's one of the most valuable lessons that you've learned from failure as an entrepreneur?
But you know, I think the most important thing is don't throw the baby with the bathwater. Very often you kind of, let's say that you decided to expand internationally and it failed. So the next time as an entrepreneur, you decide never to expand internationally. That's stupid. You know, I mean, or, you know, you make a few expensive hires and they don't work out. And then you say, look, I'm not going to get somebody expensive. Again, it doesn't make sense. So I think the key thing is to understand really why it failed. And then, you know, steer clear of that, but not kind of go O-log and take a very philosophical approach and say the whole thing is bad. So I think, you know, I mean, to me, that has been the most important thing. I've always had to keep that in mind when I decide not to do something. I just want to make sure it's for the, I've thought it through.
The right reasons.
Yeah.
What's one truth that few people agree with you on?
I mean, just in my field, I would say credit should never, ever be frictionless. You know, I keep saying this every time and I get scared when someone uses some frictionless credit. you know, I like BNPL to me has always been die now, pay later. You know, so a bunch of things. Our HR is required in a company, which is always a very dangerous thing to say. But, you know, I am not a big believer of HR. Or, you know, company is a family, which is complete. Wow. You know, but, you know, lots of stuff. I mean,
quite a few would love to jump into some of those. So let's, you know, start at the beginning, right? Let's hear about your journey right from the start. Where did you grow up? Where did you go to school?
Oh, I grew up in Mumbai. You know, so South Indian family, grew up in Jembur, which is, I think, one of the big epicenters of South Indians in Bombay. Went to school there, small little school there, and then, you know, did my engineering also from Bombay. Till I went to Ahmedabad for my, you know, MBA. I guess that was the first time I was out of Mumbai in that sense. I had a bunch of very interesting accidents along the way. I mean, MBA was not on my list. In fact, I didn't even know what an MBA was, honestly speaking. I mean, till I got kind of asked by friends to join in and apply and then got in. And then when I got in, I didn't want to go because in my family, generally, I think engineering itself was a compromise with pure science. And then MBA would have been absolutely best for me. So I must have been the most depressed guy on the campus, I think, for a long time.
Walk us through that. So you just went because you got it.
A series of accidents happened. I didn't know. I wasn't going for the interview when some boss of mine, I was doing an internship in the company, forced me to go there. In fact, he gave me his shirt, tie, you know, loaned me so that I could go a little presentable. So I went in there and, you know, once I got in, I was absolutely sure I didn't. So I came actually to Pune to join Tata Motors. You know, after my engineering, that's the place. I rented a place and all that. And I thought nobody would know about this, that I had ever even applied and gotten or something like that. And somebody told some prof of mine, and he then came down to Pune, I mean, bless his soul. And he came down and took me to Ahmedabad to say that, you know, you got to be tougher.
You have to give this a shot.
Yeah, he took me there. And so, you know, I mean, look, it took me about 6 months to figure out, you know, should I even be there? You know, it was not really my interest area. I mean, I was very much into industrial engineering and stuff like that, some strange stuff. But it took me some time. It was a great 2 years. I mean, it was great 2 years in retrospect. And even when I was there, great set of friends, all that. But, you know, it took me some time to kind of get used to the idea that I would be a snake oil pusher or something like that, which is what my general thought on MBA was. So after MBA, I got into, again, I did a pretty weird thing. There were a bunch of companies, day one, day two, day three, all the standard stuff. But, you know, there was a consulting firm that came with a guy in Bermuda shorts to interview. That was really cool.
And you're like, that's where I want to work.
That's where I want to work. And he had a very strange question to me. He asked me, what was my rank, which was somewhere in the south of, you know, wherever it should be. And then he said, oh, why did you even attempt this much? Why didn't you go even lower? And, you know, and I said, that was a very interesting take. I said, no, this is definitely a place I want to be in. So I spent 3 years in a consulting firm. It used to be called Anderson Consulting, then, you know, got renamed as Accenture. But it was a really good time. I mean, you know, I think whatever I am today, I think a lot of it goes to credit to them because I think they did multiple things. I mean, I got used to the idea of, you know, lecturing on people on stuff I had no clue about. Which is
yes,
you have. And second is, I think they sent me to Stockholm during winter for about quite a long time for a project. And, you know, that's a great place because 23 hours of no sun, you kind of introspect a lot. So, I had my first, I think, fight with HR there. And that kind of, you know, that's one thing that I got scarred for life, I think, in HR. And then that made me kind of get out and say, I'm going to do something on my own. And I think that's what set me off on the old, you know, what's now called entrepreneurship. That time it was called going in business, which was kind of a bad word.
Right. I mean, just to kind of set the context, what is the time frame here? Like around which year are we talking about?
Masa and I'm
no, no, no.
I,
nobody.
I did my B-school in 91. So this is 91 to 94. So Valentine's
Day. Your Accenture.
Yeah. And so Valentine's Day 94, I got out of Accenture, walked from Cuff Parade to VT, if you're familiar with that space.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. Called up a friend of mine and said, look, I'm bored. What about you? And he said, he's bored. And then we got together at his place and started a company in the evening.
You see this? The same day, the same day. Yeah, walk us through that process. Did you just quit without knowing what you're going to do? Like, or you had an idea that you're going to talk to this guy? And
yeah. No, I don't think there was too much thought. In fact, you know, that's what always, I get very confused when people say I'm thinking of starting something because I don't understand how you think. You know, I mean, startup is such a stupid idea. You know, if you think, you will never do it. I mean, if you think logically, you should never do it. But you know, I didn't think. Look, I had a couple of factors that happened on the way. 93 end, I was actually thinking of quitting my consulting firm and I was looking at options. Somebody directed me to this small company then in Koramangala in Bangalore. I went and visited them, met all the founders. And, you know, I really was struck by their enthusiasm. You know, the way that they were very passionate about what they were doing. It was IT services. It was a company called Infosys back in 93. And yeah. Very kind. They really kind of, you know, tried to place me in Infosys. Despite I don't think I was very competent at that time to join that firm. And then, so that happened. And I think somewhere along the back of my head, it was like, oh, this is an interesting idea being on your own, you know. And I think something else happened. You know, I used to be one of those typical people you find in offices, a smart aleck who has a funny thing to say about everybody and grumble about everybody. And I think one friend of mine once asked me, you know, don't you get tired of whining about others and, you know, blaming others? And that struck me as a very, very, I don't know why, it just struck me as a profound thought. And I thought, you know, so when this idea of business came in, I really thought it's a great idea, right? You can't blame anybody for this. Very liberating feeling, I thought, that, you know, everything you can kind of trace. So I think those are the things, but I honestly cannot say that when I got out on February 14th and did that walk, it was really about going and starting something. I just called up this guy and interestingly at that point, he was also kind of wanting to quit his job and we just started. And our idea really was nothing in this, what I'm doing today. It was about making point of sale marketing material. You know, that guy was in product, you know, a double postgraduate in industrial design from IDC and IIT and then in SUNY Buffalo. And he had some really great ideas and he was a great creating guy even now. And we thought we would make some point of sale marketing material for, you know, FMCG companies. That was the original idea. I don't know where it popped up from, but that's what it came. And by the way, the company's name was also very interesting. It was called SNR.
SNR, okay.
For simple solutions to real problems. Don't ask me what it meant, but you know, I mean, and this was done by another friend of ours who, you know, popped in and when we were discussing this, and we asked him what should be the name of the company, and he said SNR, which also, by the way, you know, a lot of people could stop for the initials. You know, I was Ramaswamy, and the other guy was Sopnesh, so they thought it was.
Oh, SNR. So it worked out that way as well.
Nice. It's not that way. You know, I mean, a lot of people thought that, but that is not the way it came in. Actually, this came in because of the simple solutions for real problems. But anyway. So we started off there, then we got into doing with NFDC, a multimedia CD of anthology of Indian cinema, which Mr. Amitabh Bachchan inaugurated. That was my brush with fame, or only brush with fame. That was an interesting one. And then that was my second, but 2015, I really wanted to get back to Vayana. By then we had a very large institutional investor who came in and I really said, okay, now this is the time for me to get out. But I remained for two more years.
Throughout those years, you had that conviction, right? Like, it sounds like you always felt like you knew Vayana was the right thing to do, or just the timing wasn't right. Or like, I mean, what I'm trying to understand the kind of conflict in your head there, because you had this company you're running, but you had this in the back burner. You had a lot of conviction about it.
Yes, actually, how did you kind of balance it? Who was in the company from 2008 onwards, right? Who were involved with it and who knew what I was interested in would say that. I just remain very doggedly thinking about that idea. So I'm very fascinated by problems. I get very bored with solutions. I don't really like solutions so much because I think they just keep on changing, right? It's okay. But problem statements are very interesting. And there's something I learned in IMA, how to define a problem statement. And I just found this old supply chain finance, the problem statement that I had kind of crafted was very, very, you know. And what was interesting to me is that through the entire period, I was fallow. I was not doing anything, which is 2009 to 2015, 16. It still had not been solved. And I would say it still is not fully solved yet. So In 2024. So I think, you know, Jeff Bezos later on was, and I heard him talking about, you know, focus on problems that don't change for the next 10 years, right? Or things that don't change for the next 10 years. I think
if you solve it, you've made a shift, right? And you've really solved something that no one else could solve.
This area is something that's interesting. I don't think it's going to change for a long time, you know, the problem statement it has. So it remained. So to go back to your question, yes, it remained. And in 2017, I said, okay, finally, let me get out. And I got out in 2017. I offered all the shareholders a right to own stock in this company. Some of them accepted, some of them didn't. And then I got funding in initial, I found there's an investor who I had known from 1998, who I had pitched Vayana, I think 5 or 6 times till 2017. Because, you know, from 2008 to 2017, this idea was on my head. And I got rejected. Because they said, look, you start it absolutely dedicated and then we'll think about it. So when I created this, I went back to them and amazingly, they decided to start. They gave me some funding. Series A happened then. And that's how Vayana grew. I mean, so that's how the whole journey has been. So, you know, a lot of people think about how did this idea come about? What did you do? And all. But I've been only on this idea. I mean, I'm a very boring guy. 30 years, I've only really been in transaction kind of stuff. And I only know B2B. I don't know anything else. I don't know B2C. I don't know InsurTech. I don't know anything of any of the other markets. I know only this damn thing. And I'm scared that, you know, I'll get caught out one day into us being something else. So
just before we go ahead, I mean, you touched on it, but can you walk us through what exactly the problem was that you were trying to solve?
So look, I mean, it's, so let me first just do a couple of quick definitions, okay? Because everybody gets very confused about it. So supply chain. In the banking world, it's very simple. A large company buying from its suppliers. So all the suppliers are the supply chain, right? So everybody who supplies raw material to you or some kind of material to you to make the final good, they are all in supply chain. In the industrial engineering world, the way we look at it, supply chain is everything that goes right up to the customer. So it includes the distribution side of it. So the way we define supply chain is right from the consumer side, right up to your smallest supplier, everybody is your supply chain. Right, because finally, there's no point of being a company unless you can get your goods to the customer.
You can actually deliver it. Yeah, makes sense.
Supply chain, both sides, it's called upstream, downstream, vendor, channel. What sort of terms? You know, like all other places, a lot of jargon. But you know, basically, that's what it is. So, in that supply chain, the interesting thing is that, and this is the funny part of it. You know, India, there's roughly about $120 billion of trade happen every month. Give or take a few billion. $120 billion. So, and there's no trade that doesn't happen without credit. Fundamentally depends on credit. Now, you could argue that, look, if I have money in my balance sheet and I'm paying cash to a vendor, then where am I taking credit? But the fact is that the cash in your balance sheet is coming through some other mechanism, right? So everything happens on credit. Yeah. Credit is kind of the, you know, I would say very embedded into the trade itself. So this $120 billion.
But it's just not. Okay. This $120 billion is all the, like, the kind of unorganized trade that people are buying goods on credit. That's really different or the whole.
Everything.
The whole thing overall, right?
The whole thing, right? So, you know, it actually gets in some sense magnified because let's just assume that, let's say you are a FMCG company that sells a packet of biscuits. To your distributor, you'll be selling it at, let's say, 100 rupees. He will sell it down the trade for 120. And by the time it reaches you as a consumer, it's 150. Now, each leg of the trade has to get financed. So actually, there are 100 rupees packet of biscuits. The actual financing that's gone into it might be about $450. Because it's gone multiple hands.
Each person got it.
That's how it multiplies considerably. Obviously, it reduces on the raw material side. Because, you know, somebody sells you for $50. By the time it reaches you, it might be $100, right? For you to get it in your shop. But again, there's a multiple legs to it. So if you add up all this, it's a very huge business. Now, the problem with supply chain is that no corporate wants to give credit, correct? Or wants to pay late. If you're on the top of the totem pole, like you are the biggest business there, you really don't want to be using your balance sheet either to give credit or take credit. You want your supply chain to take it. So that's a common thing across the world, right? So everybody wants to take credit out. So there is a tremendous need for credit to be offered to everybody who is buying or selling from this large guy. So that's as simple as that.
And every industry. I mean, every industry has it in some shape or form, I think. Yeah.
There is no industry, unfortunately, that's away from this problem. So everybody needs credit. The top guy wants the others to take the credit. Now, the big problem really is that who can give credit? It's a bank, right? I'm just going to use bank as a word. You could switch it for NBFC or you could switch it for something else, but basically any lender.
Banks
like to deal with a large guy. They don't like to deal with a small guy, right? So
makes sense. Question, you don't want to deal with 10 people, just one person distributes it for you. Right?
But the way supply chain finance is that the small guy is actually the borrower, right? Because you asked him to take money for the credit. Now that means you have to meet him and talk to him at least and get him on board. So a lot of banks decided to focus on what I call lazy banking, right? So they would take a large corporate and work with this top 10%, 15% suppliers or distributors whom he had direct influence on or were very important to him. And he basically would tell them, bhaiya, ye karna hai. And they would do it. So really for a bank, it turned out to be a very easy operation to do. They really had to only work with the large guy. And they didn't have to think about all these small guys. So they would do some due diligence on all the small guys, but they really didn't have to work with them because it was a large guy who was setting up the entire thing.
And based on their most important suppliers that they had a relationship with, they were just, okay, we can lend you.
The top 10-15% cream, everybody would work with them. So I used to sell supply chain finance systems to banks. So this is how I just stepped into the problem, right? So I used to sell supply chain finance systems to banks in my first startup. We had international clients. So before I left this company in 2007, I went and met all of these banks. And I realized that I had obviously sold it for license or whatever. I had made my money. But the fact of the matter, there's no transactions going through. So this was like I had made pipelines, but there's no water flowing through it. And that's really what set me thinking as to what's stopping it. And then I realized that all these small businesses had never even been talked to by the banks. And these small businesses
can't be bothered. So it wasn't really an infrastructure problem. It wasn't that they didn't have the tech or the ability to serve it. They just didn't have motivation.
The easiest way to understand the problem is that there was no MasterCard/Visa equivalent of this network, right?
Yeah.
I mean, fundamentally had two people, buyer and a seller. You had a bank that wanted to lend money to the small guy for buying from or selling from this large guy, but you didn't have a network that kind of bought all of them together, right? And there was no common standardized way of doing it. So, and the world had grappled with it. It was not that world had not done it. I mean, back from 1970s, there was the standards of invoicing and all of that stuff, but it really not taken off. The other big problem really that most banks didn't understand is that these small guys really didn't use all the credit. It's exactly like credit cards. You know, like you can get 4 credit cards in a wallet, but you will probably only end up using, different credit cards for different months, depending on the bonus points being
offered. Whenever you get the offer. Exactly.
So a bank was given a credit card of, let's say, $1 million, and you use it very sparingly. Actually, the bank loses a lot of money because it has to provide for that 1 million of credit. It just keeps a margin money aside for it. So the whole thing people didn't realize is that it was not just a question of covering the supply chain, which I talked about, more than the 10-15% to the 100%. It is also making sure utilization was happening of that credit being given. And banks really figured out that, and let's say you're an RM of a bank, right? You're a sales guy, forget everything else. Yeah. Finally, it boils down to just human behavior. If I'm an RM of a bank and I have got a target and I have to make my bonus and commissions, will I sell a short-term product, which is for 30, 60, 90 days with very volatile credit?
Well, it's incentives at the end of the day. They're not going to bother with it. Yeah, obviously.
But I think a one-year loan, simpler. I do my entire bonus one shot. And the fundamental problem is that someone has to be at the small guy to rotate it, right? Because after he's taken the first level of credit, so let's say if it's a 30-day credit cycle, 12 times you will rotate it. Now, if you don't follow up with him, he's not going to rotate 12 times. He'll probably rotate it 3 times. And you might rotate it at the worst time that you don't want him to rotate, which is usually season or whatever it is. All of these issues, it's fundamentally, I would say, a logistics issue. It's a distribution issue. It's a logistics issue of getting supply chain finance programs running. You really have to be at it to make sure the water is flowing down the pipeline. Second, I think the bigger issue really was the water clean? Right, because everybody was worried about the fact that these are all not just a fraud trade, right?
And it kind of spreads, right? Like, I mean, if you get into one of the wrong things, then it cascades it could be.
We really needed people who understood the trade. So one of the interesting axioms of supply chain finance is that you're not financing a borrower, you're financing the trade. So it actually requires you to understand the trade very well. So one of the reasons for 30 years I've loved this business, in the last 7-8 years I've really been enjoying this every day, is that every day you learn something new about a new trade. right? You understand what makes it tick. What are the factors playing at? You know, you take something as stupid as, not stupid, sorry, as important as, maybe not so obvious as incense sticks.
Okay.
It's quite a complicated supply chain to it.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think there's like, well, it's one thing, like, you know, not that many parts. Wow. Yeah.
In Bangkok, and I'm sure there's a lot of incense sticks flowing around there. but it's a very interesting business. You know, people don't realize how complicated the whole trade is. Because it's, you know, so when you start understanding a trade, then you know whether you can finance it or not. Like, you know, I mean, so
okay.
I think the more I got into it, the more I realized that, look, the whole business model here and the problem definition is not really about creating pipelines. It is not even just being a MasterCard First Data. It is actually being a 3PL logistics player. You know, you have to get all of these guys into the pipeline. You have to make sure that everybody's interested in being in the pipeline, everybody's engaged in the pipeline, and they're continuously you know, putting in water there.
Transacting.
Right? Transacting there. And that, I think, yeah, is the real, you know, if I were to call it the problem, why am I solving? But the real big problem we are solving, and this is very kind of, I guess, antithetical to all what is said. You know, if you really want to think about any lending, right? What is the first thing people will tell you? Oh, lending is all about collections. You know, that's the first term people will say. You know, first, oh, Gyani session.
Yes.
You know, the guy will just shake his head and he say, you know, lending is not a feature. It is a, it's all about collections. Yeah, absolutely correct. No doubts about it. But in supply chain, it's really interesting. So supply chain is a inverted microfinance model, in my opinion, right? So in microfinance, what happens is that you get collective assurance for individual borrowing. Meaning 10 people get together and say, yes, we know this lady, you know, we...
So we lend money, yeah.
Money to a lady for a sewing machine or something. And the 10 people kind of stand as guarantors kind of thing, right? To make sure that she returns her money. In supply chain finance, you have this large corporate, one guy. It's individual assurance for collective borrowing. Correct?
Yes, that's completely the opposite. Yeah. No, that's interesting.
Yes, and but the interesting thing is that to supply chain finance, you should never be, as a lender, required to do collections. Because what are you doing actually? You're just helping that guy deleverage his balance sheet. It's a large company, you're helping him deleverage his balance sheet by moving debt from his balance sheet to the debt of his suppliers or distributors. So you're helping him in cash management. You're making everything predictable. So, you know, moment he gets an invoice from a supplier, he knows in 60 days only he has to make the payment. It doesn't matter. He doesn't have to negotiate with every one of them. So the bank will advance the money to supplier as a loan, right? So the guy's cash flow is taken care. Similarly, if he's sending an invoice to a distributor, he knows on day zero, I'll get my money. So if I have a CFO sitting there, actually, supply chain finance is a cash management tool, right? So I that's the service a lender is providing. Running the business of actually paying the money on due date or getting the money back from his distributors should remain his. And that's the interesting thing that most people don't realize in supply chain finance, that actually if you end up doing collections in supply chain finance, like a normal, any other lending you happen to do, you are actually subverting the model. The model is actually about only financing the cash part of the business, not about collecting the money. Collection should always remain the, you know, the responsibility of the large guy. And the only way to do
because
that...
Because they have the power to do a lot. They have a lot more levers that they can use than you do, right?
And I'll give you a simple. Whichever company you are, you've got some suppliers, right? Now, your company has a relationship with the suppliers. Me as a lender coming, you come and tell me, boss, many suppliers, can you lend money to them? Sure, I'll go and meet them probably once or talk to them on a video call or whatever it is. I have a relationship with them.
Yeah.
I have a relationship with you, right? So if they don't give the money on time, what am I going to do? You know... I'm a bank.
You know how likely they are to give it back on time or not, and who's where.
I'll come back to Mazin and say, buddy, I helped you to kind of make sure you didn't have to pay on day zero. I allowed you to pay only on day 60 and I've given them credit. Now you better pay me on time. Or if I, on the other side, I will tell you, you go and collect the money, boss. I don't care. Now the only way you actually make him do that. Look, I mean, everybody says, oh, it's a large corporate. How can we force him to do that? Is that, look, if you're financing 10%, 5% of his supply chain, and you tell him the entire supply chain will get stopped financing, if even one guy is wrong, that's the power you have, the power of numbers you have. So I think really speaking, what we figured out is that the reason why credit costs go up by a bank for small guys. So if you're running a small startup, let's say, and you go to a bank, he's obviously going to add a huge risk premium to whatever interest rate is going to charge you, right? So let's say that his base rate is 8%. he's going to add 10% to the as a risk premium, because he's going to be worried about who values the company.
And because he doesn't have that relationship directly with the individual person.
Context, right? What you do.
Yeah.
Give him the context. I can say this is a small little shop in, interiors of Maharashtra that is a stockist for ITC. Now, yeah. By himself, the bank would say, hey, I know this is a 24% kind of interest cost candidate. But the moment I put
him but if you look at the context and who their customer is and what specific product you're financing, right, it's different. Yeah.
In fact, ITC will ensure that I repay me money on time. So now the credit cost, my 10% premium suddenly comes down. So that's one very interesting way of looking at this problem, that you can actually make the interest cost for the smallest business in a supply chain come down drastically. But there's another very important reason also to do it. And I'll tell you why. And it's a very economic reason. In India, except a few sectors, the net margin in a business at the lower parts of the supply chain is not more than 3-4%. Okay, net margin. So, you have 100 rupees, then 3-4 rupees. You know, 3-4 rupees is what you will make.
Which is a tough business. I mean, that's
If I charge you 2 rupees as interest cost on it,
that's taking more than half of your money.
People tell me, all these small guys are investing in taking more credit and investing in land. You know, why are they investing in land or crypto or whatever it is? Because their own business doesn't give them returns.
They don't have a choice, right? You're making 1%, everyone else is taking everything else. Yeah, what do you do?
The idea really is that when you give financing to them, give it to them at the lowest possible rate that they can increase their business. But more importantly, just from a behavioral psychology again, if the guy needs the money for running his business every day, and it is the cheapest form of finance available, he's going to prioritize repaying it over anything else.
He knows that if I keep paying this, I'll keep getting to run my business, and it's a tap, right? Yeah.
I'm not going to get any cheaper than this, so let me not spoil this one. Right? In addition to the fact that the guy who helped facilitate this is at his neck, breathing down his neck to make sure that he's always paying. So actually, supply chain finance business, if you run it correctly, you can actually afford give really low cost financing to even the smallest business. And more importantly, not have a collections issue, or a default issue. So that's the interesting part. So why and I know, and I'm really proud of this actually, is that our focus is to kind of keep the interest rates lower than 1% a month or annualized 12%. We aren't there. We are about 99% less than 11%. We still have about 1%, which is about 11 to 14, which we have to try and bring it down to 12. But we are really trying to make sure that there is a reason why the small guys can really grow. So I think to me, the fundamental, impact you can have is that if you really, India is a very interesting country, right? I mean, I'll just take a minute and you can edit it out later if you think it's been too long. But, there are about 60 million businesses in India. Nobody knows it for a fact. It is an often quoted number because nobody has actually done a survey, but suppose 50, 60 million. There are 12 million unique companies in the GSTN network, right?
Okay.
Out of that, so this 12 million are people who are in part of the formal data structure. Like you can get data about them and all of that stuff. Eight out of the 12 million are all small guys, small businesses.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
Yeah. In the GSTN, and the remaining 48 million that is outside GSTN are really micro and nano businesses.
Very tiny. Got it.
Right.
So it's
they're all. So the interesting thing in India, if someone were to do a real survey, is that how many of a micro or a nano business becomes a small business? How many small businesses become medium-sized? How many medium-sized? So, in the individual world, we keep saying, how do we kind of get people out of poverty? How do we get people to break the chain of poverty and all of this stuff? Similarly, in businesses, how do you make him grow? You can't make him grow unless he's willing to kind of get capital for it. And if he gets capital at an enormous cost, so one of the things I often hear people talk in panels discussions is that we have reduced the cost of borrowing for our small businesses. And if you ask them, what have you done? They said, he's taking from moneylender at 60% and we are giving at 25%. That's great. Thank you very much. But it doesn't solve the problem.
Yes, no, exactly.
Probably 50% of his total income. So my point is that if you really want to kind of think about this problem, you want to create. So the other thing is as a startup, right? So let's just come back to slightly on our side. If I charge rates of interest, I make more money. Simple, right? If I lend out at 24% or I get my banks to lend at 24%,
you make more money on each transaction. Yeah, absolutely. 2%,
3%, right? So if you look at all the retail loans that go out, they're all going at these high rates of interest. And that's why people who refer, act as, referral guys, partners, they all make 2%, 3% of that because it's a huge spread. Yeah. I am telling everybody to come to 12%. So I am going to make very little money from the banks because they are already kind of giving at at the threshold of their profitability. So I am going to get very, very little small slivers of fees. You know, and what's funny about it is that, obviously investors generally will have a problem with that, saying,
why can't you increase your rates?
But no, interestingly, India is nothing more than a chiller market. It doesn't matter where you start from because India has this radioactive half-life theory on spreads. So if you are making 100 basis point spreads on the first year, and next year you'll make only 50. And third year you'll make 25. Fourth year you'll make 12.5. And fifth year, that guy will tell you, you pay me for giving you the business. Right? That's the way to model your business. It's
Love
the business you are in. In India, if you really want to grow big, you have only two choices. Either you are selling something small units, exceptionally expensive, so that's some luxury item that you can really do. I mean, you just take your D2C brands, right? You will find all of them severely discounted. And every year they have to keep discounting because there are more people coming in. Every time somebody comes on some TV show, two more people jump into the business.
Right.
And they bring down the average rate.
And then exactly. So many stories like that, right? And then it just comes cheaper and cheaper. And then you're competing for keywords. Your marketing costs go up and your margins go down. You get squeezed both sides.
Whether you're B2B, it doesn't matter. In India, your fundamental assumption has to be that your margins are going to reduce by half every year from wherever they were there the previous year. So you have to really start being cost engineered startup. If you really want to be in the business, you have to really think about how are you going to cost engineer it. There is a good old joke about, no offense meant to anybody here, but, in a certain community is to sell commodities at the same price they bought it. And they would make money off the jute bag, right, in which the commodity came.
Yes.
Right?
No, and that's...
That is the business you have to think about, that model you have to think about. So to me, it's important that you get everybody down. Low rates, but you make small, but you have to have very high volumes. So, when you talked about Vayana having done 30 billion or whatever it is, I do roughly about a billion a month, right? Up and down, 10%, 20% a month on month. But the fact is that I am right now at 120 billion at about less than 1% of the market. Even a 5% of it is about 6 billion, right? 6 billion, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So that even if I earn one paisa, the question really is that I have quite a long, very addressable market for me to go after. And that's the only way to
It's a huge market.
The India market is a volumes market. I mean, the only people who cannot be in a volumes market are people who are selling, really branded, expensive, one of those lifestyle kind of businesses, some golf course where nobody else can come in and stuff like that. Those kind of businesses have a per unit price. Every time I talk to people, I say, any business is a standard formula, right? A into B, number of units sold and unit price. In India, unit price, you would assume, is very low. So the only choice is to increase the number of units if you want to make absolute amount of money. So I think that's the only model. So I think, Vayana, really speaking, I think three problems we have solved or we are solving. I think one is coverage. We get lots of the supply chain covered. Two is that we have increased the utilization rates. And I'll come back to how we did that. And third is that we have helped it to kind of really be affordable. And therefore, because it's affordable, it also solves the utilization problem. Because people use more of that because it's probably the cheapest, right? But last point I just want to make, is the technology part. So obviously,
can't scale and you can't do volumes without tech. There's no way. You can't do everything manually if you want to get that.
Honestly speaking, Mazin, it's hygiene. I mean, I really, this fintech word, tech fin word, I just find it silly because, and I've always found it silly, not because it's now called silly, but look, I mean, I without tech, unless you were a business that started before the 80s, and there's no business in the world that doesn't run without tech. There's no business that runs without tech. So let's leave the tech part out for a business. So if you want to call it fintech, then you may want to call it, Kirana Tech, and, everything is a tech, right?
Then you keep growing. Kirana Tech is a thing, though. I've heard people say that. So.
And second, the moment you say fintech, now, and what are you? Fin means what? Financial services, then you should be a regulated player. If they're not in financial services, what an enabler, then you're a DSA. I mean, it's a fancy word. The fact of a tech is, right? The interesting thing for me is Vayana, when we started it, right? I just thought, what are we going to become? We are going to become intermediary. Look, I mean, we can keep calling also all our fancy terms. Like, ultimately, I'm an intermediary. What are we doing? We're saying,
yeah, because there's a lender and then there's a customer and you're in the middle. I mean, at the end of the day, yeah, that's.
I'm actually adding one more friction, which was not there before. There is a friction point because if you went directly to the bank, there is
that's true.
So every one of us is a friction point. We don't realize it. We are a friction point. Now we can say we are enablers. Our tech makes it much more easier. Blah blah blah.
Wow, that's.
Nonsense.
That's old.
All intermediaries. The question really I had in Vayana when we started off is that, do we want to be a visible intermediary or an invisible intermediary? Right? And the only way we figure out that is that if we wanted someone to use us, we had to be invisible. We couldn't really go into somebody's house, knock on somebody's door and say we want to be invited inside and we want to kind of map out your house and be part of your household. Only then we can help you. It won't work. So we had to come to your house and somehow managed to do it, right? So all of our tech, very interestingly, has actually tried to figure out how do we become invisible. It is not something I can say we have been 100% successful. And every day we fight because, you know, every technologist who comes wants to set up an app and a URL and some fancy stuff. You know, you can't, everybody needs something to identify with, even within Vayana, I guess.
Yeah.
Urge. The fact of the matter is that the guy who's using you doesn't care a shit about you, right? I mean,
it doesn't matter. You might not even...
He wants to get money cheap. You help him. Thank you very much. He will take one agarbatti and put on your frame and maybe do twice in the morning. But that's what he wants to do. Out of, I mean, he doesn't want to. So the best thing for you to do is to give him what he wants and stay silent about it. There is no other, you know, and that actually is an incredible, you know, I think important thing. You know, now people talk about embedded finance, right? And I think it's a good term. I mean, I have no objections to the term, but I just think you have to be embedded. There's no other choice because you not only embedded, you also have to make it without thinking about it, right?
I mean, it's just a new term, but it's what you've been doing for years and years.
Really like the card. I know I spent a lot of time in the credit card world, even from my first startup. And one of the things that struck me about credit card is two things, right? What you realize anywhere in the world, it works the same way. Pretty much the same way. I mean, you know, I mean, India mein ek aur do step jyada badhta hai kabhi kabhi, lekin overall everywhere.
Yeah, but it's same thing. At the end of the day,
All of us it is muscle memory. We don't think about credit card at all when we are paying. I mean, we think we are doing a payment. We are actually taking a loan.
Yeah, but it's just so automatic that it seems natural, right? Like you don't even think.
Yeah, but says I am taking a loan to pay this card. When I'm giving a credit card, in my head there is nothing going on. I'm using and taking a loan. I'm just thinking I'm paying.
Not at all. Yes, exactly.
Payment mechanism, which is silly because it's actually a fraud mechanism. Unless it's a credit card or it's a charge card, right?
Right. It's you're taking a loan at that point in time. Yeah.
One factor, the experience is that you don't require to really think about it when you're using it. So you really have to, so to me, that was a lesson I took from supply chain finance world, that if someone has got multiple invoices going on in a day, he has to, you know, you take an auto component guy, simple example, right? If you're an auto component guy, you're servicing three or four large guys. You know, you're servicing Bajaj, Auto, Tata Motors, Maruti, blah, blah.
Right.
Each of them will bring his own set of banks and tell you, this is the way you will run supply chain finance. And this is how you will send us data. And this is how you will, you know,
Nightmare. For this small company that maybe has like two people working in IT, you know, like,
In a lot of small companies, there's no IT at all. So, you know, you really have to think about how do I get this guy onboarded without even having to worry about what new, you know, it's like your, you know, software today, I had to suddenly learn how to download Chrome, right? Which I don't allow Google on my laptop. I had to do it today for you guys. But, you know,
views. Thank you. Appreciate.
But the point is that it made me think, you know, and I had to do some stuff. And for a small business, the biggest bandwidth issue he has is time. You know, if you ever go to a grocer shop, you will find that he's doing from 7 in the morning to 10 at night and he's busy.
Constantly something or the other.
He's an interrupt-driven guy. He's got 25 different things going on. In the midst of that, you're going to tell him, look, I've downloaded an app on your phone and, you know, this is in the fourth window. And every time you want something, you click on this app. It's a beautiful app. It'll open up to a page where you will get a pie chart of all the current business you are doing and you'll rotate. Red color will tell you what you want to know. You click here and then you will get... able to upload invoice and, you know, make sure it is not blurry and it is not on a shiny surface, and then later on you take a photo of the days, and then you upload it. Oops, yeah. The internet is not working. You have to do it again. I think a lot of this is just basic common sense. You don't need tech thinking like anything else. You just have to sit in front of a customer and realize one day you spend with him and you realize what you really have to solve for. You have to solve for getting
simple solutions like you.
You have to solve for getting out of
said long term.
I think most
exactly
most startups invisible and their purpose in life is to get out of their customer's life. And that if most startups work that way, I think that would be a great place to work with. You know, the number of apps I have on my phone is ludicrous. Yeah, every Tom, Dick, and Harry has an app because he thinks he's doing something for me. Now long rant over. Now you can continue with the rest of your question, Mazin. I'm sorry, I kind of used all your bandwidth on this one.
You know, this was a lot of fun. Thank you so much. And I'd like a couple of things. So I want to come back to the question that you gave me at the start, right? Which is, do you still think that you're a good fit for your current role? And maybe you need to preface that by explaining how your role has changed over the years. And right now, are you still a good fit? And how have you had to evolve to stay there?
The reason I told you to ask that question is that's a question I do ask myself. And the reason for that is Vayana is a very interesting structure. So Vayana, the best way to look at Vayana for someone looking at it from outside is it's like a train, right? It's a train with a very fixed destination and I'm running on very predefined tracks. So it looks like an organized train. But Vayana is composed as a train, is composed of many compartments. So one of the things that we realized long back, I told you, credit is a logistics game. When you want to do supply chain financing, it's a logistics game. So you have to do not just finance. You can't just say, I'm an underwriting and I'm giving credit or I'm a platform. You have to do many things to get the credit available to people, right? So I have to do credit assessment. I have to get into compliance. It is not because I am opening up many avenues for revenue and I want to kind of stitch together. It is that to get credit, I have to do 5 different things to get into credit. So if you take a company like Flexport, and look at the internet history of the menus of Flexport website, you will find that they also have to build like a logistics player, multiple things to get to where they are now, right? They can be asset light. They may have to be a little in some areas asset heavy. Some areas they have to kind of get into being just information providers. Some areas have to be platform, blah, blah, blah. So Vayana is really like a train with many compartments. My job is 2 things only. One, to keep the train running on the tracks, not derail it, get it to that point.
Yeah.
And second is to make sure all these compartments have a vestibule going between them so that people can freely move between the compartments. But each compartment can have its culture. So I'm a very big believer of not being good about monocultures. You know, I don't think there is in nature a monoculture. And then we'll all be dead. I think every company, irrespective of what it talks about, values, mission, vision, and all that, has multiple cultures. Even if you take a company like Apple, you take anybody, even if you take NVIDIA, the latest darling, I'm sure within different departments, they have different cultures because they're very different businesses. The guy who's
different.
He's going to be very, very organized, very systematic. He has to be. I mean, he has got to be a guy paying attention to the absolute nth level of detail. The guy who's thinking about design is a different business, right? So you can't be one culture. I mean, it beggars belief. So you really, as today, my role is to make sure every compartment is properly meshing in. Every compartment can really go full, be successful. And everybody who is in each compartment, I make them successful. So I think in that role, I'm very, very good. I think the question that really needs to get asked is that as it moves into more and more and more into execution, and you want to make this passenger train into Vande Bharat to bullet train, then what do you need? And I think I really will have to learn a lot of tricks to make it a bullet train. I don't think I'm this point in time to be a bullet train engine driver. I really need to kind of either learn or give up, you know, 2 choices. And I think that's one area I keep on thinking about, right? Because I see very quickly Vayana becoming a bullet train. It is performing well, it should become a bullet train from Vande Bharat. 160 kilometers, it has to go to 320 kilometers per hour. But it has, when it gets there, it has to
be
different skill sets.
Makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, so, you know, am I a good MiG-21 pilot? Yes. Am I a good Sukhoi fighter? I might learn now. But a complete autonomous fly-by-wire plane, I have to learn.
Different thing, right? Different journey and different different destination.
I mean, I, you know, somebody had to drag me out of this business, but I think from a coach point of view, I think what I have to prove to them is that I can, I've developed the skills to run it that way. If I haven't, then they have to find someone else. But, you know, I think it's very important for founders to ask this, because, you know, everybody talks about the 0 to 1, 1 to 100. You know, there's a good framework. Look, I mean, you know, there was some question I saw in your sheet that said consultants, what are they good at? What are they bad at? Right. So consultants are now
yes.
just 2x2 matrices, right? I mean, if we carry X and Y axis, dalenge, char W mein dalenge sabko. Ye 0 to 1. Construct. The fundamental point is that if you map out your startup's journey, you may not even, you may be only good for 0 to 0.25 or from 1 to 10. You may not be good for 1 to 100. 1 to 100 is a huge range, buddy. So,
exactly. You can't, everyone can't do everything. And I think knowing what you can and can't do is.
So I think that's very important. Right? I think for me, that's a, I mean, it's a question you have to ask yourself every day. You know, I mean, the screensaver of my laptop right now, which is very important to me, is the problem statement we are trying to solve. Every day I have to figure out, is it still relevant today? You know, because one of the worries you always have as a startup founder is not the solution. The solution can be crappy and you can, you have time to fix it and you can try and fix it. But if you misunderstand the problem, nobody can save you. Right. So I have to really every day look at this problem statement that comes up on my screensaver when I'm not doing anything and figure out back of my head. I have to think about, yeah, yeah, be relevant. Hai ki main kuch to, I'm living in my own, you know, prior definition of it. So I think that's the key thing. But similarly, I have to ask myself the question, am I the right engine driver for this train? You know, depending on what speed I want.
No, I love that analogy. And just to wrap up, you've given us many pieces of unfiltered advice and many insights. But since this is a question we ask all our guests, what is some unfiltered feedback that you received that really impacted you personally or professionally?
So I, actually three I got. So I mean, I'm going to tell you all the three and they have stuck with me for a long time. So the very first one I got in my B school by a friend of mine when I was doing a project with him is that I was as usual marrowing some fatte. And he said, yaar, you know, you can fool anybody else you want, but never try and fool yourself because that will be dangerous. And it stuck with me, you know, I like one of those things, you know, said, informally or casually, but you know,
just random thing someone said.
Yeah. So yeah. Stuck with me, right? That's like a very, very big thing that I look. I think second, someone told me that my co-founder again, in my, one of my startups told me that, look, you get very engrossed with the intellectual problem definition side of it. You really are not so interested in whether it's really successful or not, because, you know, I keep telling I'm interested in the problem, not the solution. So he always said, you know, if you really want to do something, you do it at scale in India, otherwise don't do it. And that struck me. Yeah. So to me, scale is a very important metric of whether my really my understanding is correct or not. It is not just a scale.
No, for
anything. Yeah.
You set up your business that way, I think. I loved how you spoke about the importance of having low margins so that you really are built for scale, right? Not just making as much as you can on day one.
So that's all came on me as my third startup. My first two startups were not there. My first two startups really, without that feedback, I probably would have still continued building a very, I think, admired, liked business, but never scaled up, right? It would have been one of the boutique businesses. So I think that second feedback that I got in was very, very important. And third thing, I think someone said, which I think is not their quote or their advice, but it is that, you know, don't let people mistake your niceness for weakness. I'm a very conflict avoiding person. I don't like conflicts. I don't really like getting personal at any level with any conversation. And a lot of people mistake it sometimes for, especially in a startup hustle environment where there is a lot of adrenaline flowing, that, you know, this is too soft. You know, you have to have a few swear words and you have to have some, you know, whatever you have to do, you know, some testosterone flowing, I guess. And I just find it silly.
Hey,
you know, I keep telling people I'm not running a nursery school. I mean, I don't need to kind of shout at people. Yeah. But the fact is that I think the con of it is also true. You have to make sure people understand you for what you're standing for. And that, you know, they don't kind of assume that you're nice just because you're weak. You're nice because you think that's the right way of doing business. I think that was an important piece of advice for me because I just assumed people would, just treat niceness as niceness and nothing more than that. But I think it's important. It's important to kind of, you know, be nice. I really, so we have three things that I am very, you know, emphatic about in the company. You know, be nice, be yourself, and be curious, right? So be yourself is very, very important to me. You know, I find it very scary when people try to be things they are not truly are because then, you know, it's like people, who will always cause accidents.
Amazing. Ram, Thank you so much. It's been amazing. Really has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time and for joining us on the show.
Hey, thanks. Yeah, sorry, it's taken really long. Yeah, it's 90 minutes down. Yeah.
No. It was a pleasure. Learned a lot and we laughed a lot and I had a great Sunday. So thank you so much for spending time with us.